concerts, they're truly one of the joys of summer in Canada. You meet up with friends, you go to a stadium, maybe a festival, maybe an amphitheater down by the water, and for a few hours, you get to forget about the world and join together with perfect strangers enjoying the bliss of live music. Hello, I'm Brian Lilly, and this is the Full Comment Podcast. The music industry has definitely changed over the last several years, decades even. Before we get to our next guest, who knows so much about this and more, I want to remind you, I want to ask you, I want to beg you even to hit that subscribe button and make sure you don't miss a single episode of Full Comment, where, yes, we talk about the weighty issues of the world, but we also talk about those issues that give joy and meaning to life. So whatever app or device you're listening on, please hit subscribe. My first major concert was a stadium show. I saw David Bowie at Toronto's Exhibition Stadium with the opening act of Duran Duran. The pre-opening act was a little-known Canadian act at the time called the Northern Pikes. It was a great show, and my floor seats, just 30 rows back from the stage, cost me a grand total of $35 when I was just 15 years old. Adjusted for inflation, that would amount to about $80 today. The concert industry today isn't so much about giving fans a taste of the music as it is about giving the artist the good life, a good income. As Milhouse once said to Bart Simpson, "You've changed, man. It used to be about the music." I'm sure that's a sentiment that our next guest can relate to. Eric Alper is a music publicist. He's also the host of That Eric Alper Show on Sirius XM and probably the biggest music fan I've ever encountered. Eric, thanks for the time today.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Great to see you.
Good to see you again. Now, would you agree with me?
Duran Duran and Bowie and Northern Pikes. How many layers of the ozone layer do you think would destroy that very night thanks to that show in the audience?
Due to the hairspray?
Yeah.
Peter Frampton played for Bowie.
Yeah.
He was the guitarist on that tour.
David Bowie literally saved Peter Frampton from oblivion when after Frampton sold a gazillion albums of Frampton Comes Alive, his next album, Stiffed, with only selling 4 million copies in America, and nobody wanted to work with him until, you know, he was kind of lounging around doing a whole lot of nothing, really, and David Bowie plucked him out of doing nothing because he was such a big fan of Humble Pie, the band that Frampton was in before going solo. So here's David Bowie taking somebody that he's long admired and turning him into another superstar for the next couple of decades.
And when I tell people that was the lineup, they always look at me like, what? Duran Duran and David? Duran Duran was the opening act? Yeah, they were kind of on the way down, I guess you could say. They were in a lull. At that point, they'd been huge in the early 80s, and then by 87, it was, ooh, do I want to be seen with Duran Duran? So it was an interesting and eclectic concert, to say the least. But
yeah, that was the Glass Spider tour, right? Was that the something like that?
Glass Spider tour, anyway. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you, what was your first big concert? Not like, you know, down at the local community hall or whatever. What was your first big concert that you went to?
The first concert I saw was on December the 6th, 1981, and it was at Maple Leaf Gardens, and it was Genesis, who was and still is my favorite band at the time. I went with my sister. Mm-hmm. I got an immense contact high because you can smoke inside the building at the time. No idea what was happening to me. But ever since then, I think I have been chasing that psychological high whenever I see concerts. It's not necessarily that I'm the one sitting in the back with my arms folded going, this is as great as Genesis back in 81. But that night was astonishing to me. Not only did I get to see the bodies, right? I got to see the band live, which is still why people spend thousands of dollars on tickets. It's psychological. It's all of that stuff. But they want to see the body in front of them. And also, just, I don't think I've ever witnessed that many people all in the same place at the time when I was, you know, 11 or 12 years old. So that was wild to me. And then ever since then, you know, I think for about 10, 15 years, I think I might have seen at least a concert a week. I was, you know, always down at Maple Leaf Gardens. It was Kingswood Music Theater at Canada's Wonderland, Ontario Place. I remember one summer I think I must have saw maybe 20 or 30 concerts one summer just by Ontario Place in the C&E Grandstand alone, because it was cheap. It was like $4, $3 for a show.
Yeah, in my younger years, I went to more concerts than I can remember now. And people say, well, have you seen that band? And I have to sit there and say, I think so. especially when you consider the festivals and you'd see 15 acts in a day. But
that's okay, because those artists don't really remember that tour very much either.
Before we get into talking about how this industry has changed and all of that, another question on your musical experience. So you said you've been chasing that high from seeing Genesis in 1981, and I don't think you mean the Contact high, but what's your favorite concert? Is there one or two that stand out for you the most?
I've seen so many concerts. I've never really walked out of a show, whether it's a club show or whether it's a major concert, and be disappointed, because whenever I get bored or whenever it's somebody that I've seen a lot of time, I love to just people watch, knowing that there are people and fans that have saved up a lot of money to go and see this. Maybe they've traveled from out of town. Maybe it's their first concert ever. Maybe it's the first time that they're seeing this band. And that's what I love. That's what I still love about this industry and why I love working 17 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's that experience of sharing music and talking about it, whether it's in person or online. The experience of watching other people love what is so wonderful about music in the first place. But I have to say, though, I didn't really get Ed Sheeran. I understood where he was coming from. I get the popularity. I see his chart numbers. I have the albums. I've listened to it. My wife and daughter are massive fans. I finally got to see him a couple of weeks ago here in Toronto, and I walked out of there completely blindsided about how brilliant he was as a musician. He showed off his foot pedals. He had a couple of amazing special guests and people that I wasn't expecting. So I'm going to say Ed Sheeran recently was at the top of my list whenever people say, who do I need to see? And it's like, you got to go see Ed Sheeran. 3 hours of just nonstop hits of so many different musical styles, because that's what he's built his career on.
Those concerts, and I wished I'd gone to see Ed Sheeran. Actually, I tried to get in to see him at History, which, for people that don't know, is a small club in Toronto. The guy played a club show for what do they hold,
on, like
1,500, 2,000 people maybe, and then played Rogers Centre, pretty much sold out for two nights. And but those tickets at places like Rogers Centre, where I also saw David Bowie later with the dancer from La 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 Human Steps, just him and her on stage. They used to be affordable. We thought they were ridiculous when I was spending $35 in 1987 to see Bowie. As I said, you adjust that for inflation, it's $80 now. You can't find a show for that ticket price. So how can kids today afford that? I was working a minimum wage job at a supermarket the summer I went to see Bowie. How can kids today afford to go see a show when their favorite act costs hundreds, or in the case of one young lady that we'll talk about in a minute, Taylor Swift, thousands of dollars a ticket? How can people afford this? Is it sustainable?
Yeah, I think it's interesting when people talk about inflation, because, you know, I always keep seeing that somebody that had a regular full-time job could afford a home and having two kids and a car, and that was the way of life. And now it's just simply not. And concert tickets were always set, even then, by the artist. Just the artist had no idea of the sheer demand of how much they could actually get for their tickets. Even though that they understood the scalping market was there, they just didn't care about it, because they knew that they were going to walk out of there with $70,000 in their pocket at the time in the 70s and 80s, where you figure, you know, maybe 10,000 people, $7 a head, you get to $70,000, you pay off the venue and so forth, and you're walking out of there with maybe $50,000. That was really good money, considering if you were selling 10,000 tickets, you were probably also selling 50,000 copies in that city or this country in album sales that were $27.99 for a vinyl record, or a CD at $20. So there was always something to fall back on of I'm not going to rely only on one aspect of the industry for my money. There are so many other ways I can do it. I can sell t-shirts, I can sell hats, I can tell people to join the fan club and so forth. Now, unless you're at the 0.1% of the top of the triangle, the top of the pyramid, you're a superstar artist like Taylor Swift or Justin Bieber or The Weeknd or Ariana Grande, you're taking home, or Elton John, or many classic rock artists like Kansas and Styx and Kiss and Journey and Foreigner, who are all on tour making hundreds of millions of dollars. In fact, Elton John ended off his tour with $910 million of grosses, selling just over 8.5 million tickets sold. So you take a look at that and you think, wow, that's pretty amazing. But Elton John is not nearly making nearly as much money as he was when he was selling albums, because really, except for Taylor Swift, nobody's really selling a lot of records. Nobody's selling a lot of physical product, and Spotify and for the most part are still stuck at the 0.0004 cents per stream. So every million streams that you get on Spotify, you're making about $4,000. That goes to all the rights holders.
$4,000 for a
million.
And
that's split up by the record. Yeah. And that's split up by the record label, the publisher, the other musician, the producer, the engineer, the studio. All of those people need to get paid. And then the musician and the songwriters are last. So,
So let's pause here.
So you take a look at it and you're like, you have to make money on the road.
So is this why and how the industry has changed so much because of the way we consume music now? I forget what my music streaming plan is. It's like $12.99 a month or something, and I can listen to whatever, and then that money is split up by what I listen to and what everybody else listens to. But you're saying that whether it's Spotify or Google or iTunes, Apple Music now, I guess, that it's about that same level of payment?
Yeah, give or take about $500 or so between that million streams, right? So when you're Drake or The Weeknd and you have a number of songs over 1 billion, that's pretty good. That's $4 million worth of revenue that you get to kind of share. When you're Taylor Swift and you have 11 songs over $1 billion, that's pretty good. But again, that's the 1%. We're not talking most. There was a statistic that I saw. It was somewhere in the neighborhood of 96% of all songs on Spotify have less than 100 streams. Because after you go and beg your family and your friends to listen to your music, most people don't have a publicist. Most people don't have a manager or a record label or a marketing plan or Canadian music grant to help you promote. So most people are making essentially 0.04 of a penny because that's what they deserve to get. Because that's how many people are listening to you. So yeah, the music industry always divided the money based on the format that we were all listening to. In the 1990s, when music consumerism was really at its peak, not only did you have cassettes still selling, you had maybe CDs on year 7. So every record store was fully stocked to the floor to the ceiling with CDs at $27, $28, $29, $30. And that generation of late 80s, early 90s music fans were not only buying Nirvana and Michael Jackson and grunge music and Britney Spears and NSYNC and Backstreet Boys, they were also buying Pink Floyd and The Who and Janis Joplin and The Doors. Albums that they didn't really spend any more money re-releasing, that was all purely profit to the music industry. The average ticket was around $8 to $10. The Eagles broke through with the $100 ticket a couple of years later, which shocked everybody. Mm-hmm. But that was the Eagles. They wanted to have the most money possible. And they quickly realized that on the secondary market, they were not getting a penny. That's where it really starts with the rebirth of Ticketmaster, of Live Nation, of AEG, working on behalf of the artist to try to get as much money as possible from the live show.
I sold concert tickets for the first time recently because I couldn't go. And that never happens. And so I had to learn about this secondary market and to sell my tickets, because now they're digital. Now they're on your phone. to sell the tickets, I had to use the secondary market. I had to go through Ticketmaster. Well, right. They not only charged me a sale fee, they charged the person buying the tickets from me $49.95 per ticket to buy.
Yeah.
They set a minimum price. It's just, I had to cancel a couple of hours before the show. So I thought, well, let's sell them cheap and quick. Nope, you're not allowed. They set a minimum price above the face value of the tickets.
Yep. That's their way of stopping bots. It's interesting. People that want the government to do something about the secondary market are usually the first ones to realize that if you do that, they'll realize that most consumers want the protection to be able to do what they want with their ticket. Why should concert tickets be the only thing on the planet that you are not allowed to resell? Those prices of those fees of Ticketmaster, they go to the venue, they go back to the artist, they go back to the promoter, and about 10 to 15% of that ticket fee actually goes to Ticketmaster for allowing you to have the platform to resell it in the first place. Make no mistake, Ticketmaster is a wonderful system that deals with almost 600 million tickets a year that they sell. They get about 3.5 billion visits to their website. And I'm not a Ticketmaster apologist whatsoever or Live Nation. I get the frustration. Believe me, I don't get free tickets to anything. So I pay for it. And a lot of times I'm shut out too. But Ticketmaster is nothing more than a platform that the artist dictates to Live Nation or AEG, the promoter that's bringing them to that to the city, and Ticketmaster using their platform to sell. The artists are dictating everything. They get to decide, hey, I want to have bots allowed in. I don't want to have bots allowed in. I want to allow reselling. And, you know, that's why a lot of these artists that are kind of giving permission, even when you resell it on the secondary market, the artist is still getting money from that.
Well, at least the artist is getting money, because for a long time that wasn't the case.
But
yeah. At the same time, Ticketmaster is something that people have been complaining about for years.
Sure.
I think it was for Bruce Springsteen in the 80s. They brought out the wristband to try and stop scalpers from buying all the tickets. And that became a thing. You know, we're dating ourselves, Eric, because we remember lining up at actual sales outlets to get tickets.
But you know what? Because I worked at a Ticketmaster outlet. You know what happened when people did that? The scalpers started making deals with Ticketmaster box office staffers in order to pull 40 to 50 tickets even before they opened up the doors at 8 o'clock in the morning. So scalping was always available. Now the artist gets a say in how many tickets they're allowed to have on the reselling market. And the competition, there's more competition to sell tickets than ever before. There's SeatGeek. There's Ticketmaster is the biggest by far. They're almost averaging about 65 to 70% of the North American market for major venues. But there's still a lot of heavy-duty competition out there in case if the artist doesn't want to go through Ticketmaster. It's just that Ticketmaster is so good at limiting their profit and ensuring that they're not overpaying for the artist and doing things fair so that the artist wins, the consumer wins, and Ticketmaster gets a little bit of their cut. Believe me, they're still making money, but they're only making money because concerts are back with a vengeance where, you know, right now, in terms of the halfway point of 2023, concert tickets are almost up about 35% in North America. And in most cases around the world, that number is pretty stable. So there's more tickets being sold to more events and more artists are out on tour, mostly because they haven't had a chance to go out on tour in over 3 years due to COVID and the isolation period.
I started going to concerts as soon as I could. So I guess the summer of 2021, and we were on an up and down ride. But I can tell you that the venues that I go to are much more packed. Is that part of what is driving the ticket prices higher? Or is it this dynamic pricing model that we're hearing about now that's annoying a lot of fans, generating outrage from politicians? First off, tell me about the dynamic pricing model. How does that work?
So much to unpack there. Yeah. So dynamic pricing is the ability for the artist to dictate to the promoter, whether it's Live Nation or AEG, to allow X amount of tickets to be sold using dynamic pricing. And what that is that those are tickets that fluctuate based on the demand specifically for that seat. Live Nation and AEG and the artists and Ticketmaster have a wealth of data at their disposal. They take a look at the last tour and how many tickets were sold. They took a look at the secondary market to see how much tickets were sold in terms of scalping and how many dates that artist is going to be playing, how far apart. And they kind of come up with a number to say, we can have three tiers of $500 and $200 and $100 seats, and we'll sell this amount at this amount, and you'll walk home. If we wipe everything clean and you sell out, you'll walk away with $22 million for these dates. Dynamic pricing allows the artist to say, well, let's take these 100 tickets and fluctuate them based on the demand specifically for those seats, instead of having somebody perhaps resell it on the secondary market. But what's interesting is that we see this all the time with just as much anger. If you try to buy an airline ticket going to New York 3 hours before your flight, you're going to be paying a lot more than when you did 6 months ago. I went to go buy a bag of lettuce not even 2 days ago, and it was $8.99. 3 weeks ago, it was $3.99. Tomorrow, it could be $7.99 for all I know. So we're used to this dynamic pricing and don't even think twice about it, except for, wow, things are going up. So dynamic pricing has come to the music industry in that aspect of it. That's just a way. But the artist has every right to say, I don't want dynamic pricing. I don't want to have reselling ability. But it kind of impedes based on their profits and losses, too, if they don't do that.
So is it the artist trying to get more money? Is it people coming back from COVID? Is it a combination of the two? These ticket prices that are $500 for Beyonce recently in Toronto, or, you know, you mentioned the Eagles, their ticket prices ain't cheap. Taylor Swift, we'll get to her again in a moment. But what is it that's driving it? Is it all these things coming together combined with inflation?
Pretty much. It's really everything. It's the lack of other revenue sources that the artist has. I mean, certainly it's much better in some ways than it was back in the 70s and 80s when it was incredibly uncool to sell out, to sell your song to advertisers or put them in movies or films. Certainly having TV and movie streaming services allows artists to put more and more potential of their music on these 14 or 15 different platforms where they all need music. So there's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that I think the artists are getting really smart and woke up all one day and said, how come the secondary market can sell my tickets for $4,000 for a pair of tickets when I put them on sale for $100? How come I'm not getting a piece of that? That scalper did nothing to help get that profit. I did. And it's also based on demand. It's based on the cost of transportation and staffing. Inflation has certainly made the price of gas go up. So the cost of travel, when you're somebody like Taylor Swift or Ed Sheeran, you might be bringing anywhere between 250 people and 800 people with you and your entourage to just set up that show. That's everybody from the roadies to the lighting to the catering and on and on. The venues also have a very, very big stake in all of this to sell out. They not only get a percentage of the profits of those tickets, but you know, when you're a place like the Rogers Centre in Toronto, you know, you have to have staff, you have to have catering, you have to have people selling the beer and the alcohol and parking and security and all of that stuff. And those things are much more expensive per hour to put out than maybe 10 years ago. So everything is much more expensive. But you're right, concert tickets are a little bit more, but it's just because the artist wants more money.
All right.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Like,
we're a long way from Billy Bragg saying, threatening his record label that he would name his next LP £8.99 if they try to put the price too high.
Tom Petty battled his record label MCA back in the late 1970s when his first album was such a success, they wanted to raise his next album's price retail by $1. And it was a Hard Promises album. And he didn't want a $9.99 price point at retail. He wanted it to be $8.98. He actually physically declared bankruptcy so that his record label couldn't sue him in order for him to be forced to put out his music the way that he wanted to. The album came out eventually. It was $8.98. But yeah, you know, the artist certainly has much more power because they know that they don't really... I mean, look, when you're Taylor Swift, absolutely, you need the record label and the management. But for most artists these days, they could just post on Instagram and reach people 10 times better than they can having a record label distributor do it for you.
We'll talk about Taylor Swift when we come back in a moment and a tweet from a certain well-known politician in Canada and I'll ask Eric Halper, do we have a problem with not enough stadium space in Canada? Is that why she's not coming? Talk about that when we come back. She's the biggest superstar in the world. Once upon a time, maybe Justin Trudeau could have said that about himself in the political world. His stars faded. Taylor Swift continues to rise. So the fact that he tweeted at the global superstar recently and her decision not to announce any Canadian tour dates caught some people by surprise. He got some praise. He got some slagging for it. But he just simply said, it's me. Hi. I know places in Canada that would love to have you. So don't make it another cruel summer. We hope to see you soon. The fact that Justin Trudeau and before him, Conservative MP Matt Genereux, have tried to get Taylor Swift to come to Canada hasn't really helped. She has announced a world tour that includes dates across North America, across South America, across Europe. She's playing 3 sold-out nights in Edinburgh, Scotland, in a country that has less people than the Toronto area alone. So why? Why isn't she coming here when Canadian markets can attract some of the other biggest names in the world? Is she just too big for Canada? Eric, what do you think?
I think it's a number of reasons. The fact that we simply are a massive country in terms of land mass with not a lot of people is reason number one. The entire population of Canada fits into the tri-state area of New York, New Jersey, and Boston, and it's still lower than the population of California. So when you're looking at a map of Canada and you're looking at the size of the venues, it's a very easy decision sometimes, it's very easy to say, I can spend this amount of money to play Vancouver, Toronto, Ottawa, Montreal, and maybe Halifax. Bring in all these people, spend all this time traveling when I can play another 6 shows in Los Angeles and make double the money and not have to worry about perhaps a 35% loss in revenue because of the exchange rate. I have to now worry about getting people passports. I have to worry about visas. I have to make sure that everybody on my team can actually enter the country. And, you know, more importantly, she is getting pulled by every single country in the free world in order to visit. It's not like that she's never come here. She came here 5 years ago. People have to just calm down a little bit and realize that, you know, she is eventually going to hit Canada. Maybe my guess is going to be fall or winter 2024. She's playing on average 11 to 15 months in advance for these dates, which is astonishing. Growing up, you would never... It would be so egotistical for an artist in July to think I'm still going to be just as popular next November in order to sell out 50,000 seats. But these are what artists are doing now, which is incredibly wild to me. So it's a lot of things. It's the dollar, it's the size, it's the venues, and it's the fact that, I don't know, maybe she's just mad that secretly she kind of bid on the Ottawa Senators and didn't get that either.
She's probably the only celebrity we didn't hear wanted to bid right. on the Ottawa Senators.
Right.
You look at the stadium capacity in Canada, I mentioned Murrayfield in Edinburgh. That has a capacity of 67,000 people before you put anybody on the field.
Yeah.
Commonwealth Stadium is the biggest in the country, and it's 56,000. Olympic Stadium is 56,000, but you've got to worry about concrete falling on you. Rogers Centre is just over 40,000. Those are big numbers. Those are massive numbers. But if you can sell out 67,000, 75,000, where are you going to go?
Yeah, absolutely. And then that it always it doesn't it always just come down to money? She can play at Temple Stadium in Arizona and get 75,000 people there. So, you know, when you're again, when you're that big, and she is probably the biggest artist that I can remember that had this kind of a demand, with probably Michael Jackson in terms of a solo artist. And maybe before then, it might have been the Beatles. I mean, she's got 11 albums right now on the Billboard 200 album chart.
Hold on. Pause there. You just brushed over that amazing statistic.
Yeah.
Just quickly. Repeat that slowly. How many albums on the Billboard 200 at once?
She's got 11 of her 12 albums right now are on the Billboard 200 album chart. She's got 4 albums in the top 10. Both those marks and those accomplishments, she becomes the first woman ever in music history to accomplish this. She now has 11 number one albums. She now has 12 number one albums on the Billboard 200 album chart. The most by any woman. She just broke the record by Barbra Streisand. She is now third all time behind Drake and the Beatles. She simply is the biggest artist in the world. There's nobody that even a smidgen comes close to it. She had 22 songs on the Billboard Hot 100 last week. She's got 22%. One in every four. Here's another statistic that'll blow your mind. One in every four albums that were sold this month in July in North America and the UK is a Taylor Swift album.
Wow.
One in four. That's why she dubbed her tour the Eras Tour. All of her albums are reselling again.
Yeah, and I want to ask you about that tour, because she's not the only one doing it. You said Ed Sheeran as well, these mammoth long tours. But, I mean, just those numbers you're describing put her in a class on her own. But if you're talking album sales, is it because people aren't buying albums? In many ways, we've gone back to the era of my parents' childhood. They didn't buy albums, they bought singles. And maybe people aren't physically buying a 45 and then that little plastic thing you put in the middle to make it work. They're not buying that, but they're listening to singles on their streaming service. Is that why she's so big and by herself, or is it just in all fronts, she's just massive?
Yeah, I mean, she's really one of the best when it comes to engaging her fans. I mean, all of her fans, dubbed Swifties, actually truly believe that Taylor Swift is her friend. And his friend. And she just has this psychological hold on her fan through nothing bad. She's not going to turn them into a cult, but she was just able to tap into social media better, I think, than anybody else does. About 4 or 5 years ago, Billboard changed the algorithm of their charts so that the different formats of each of the albums count separately as a sale, meaning that if you were Taylor Swift and you put out an album and 4 different retailers have 4 different copies with 4 different track listings, say that there's a bonus track, one for Target, one for Walmart, one for whatever independent record stores, and one for only her website, and a fan buys all 4, usually it would only count as one album sale because it's the same album. Billboard divided all that up, so now it counts as 4. Now you see Taylor Swift and BTS and Ed Sheeran and Drake and all of these superstar artists make anywhere between 15 and 30 different versions of the album. Taylor Swift's brand new record, Speak Now, Taylor's version, has 7 to 10 different colored copies of the vinyl. And her fans, you better believe, are buying each one of them up to show what a big fan they are, to talk about it online. So each
they've
one
got,
of those counts
they've got
as 10.
Different track listings, but it also it might be a green vinyl, let's say.
It might be a green vinyl. It might be Taylor's, I can't remember if it was Taylor Swift. I think Taylor Swift's Midnight album, the one that she released last time, there were 4 different back covers of photos. And if you bought all 4 of them and put them side by side with one another, they actually turned into a giant poster like photo. And fans were showing each other on social media who was the biggest fan. In some cases, you have to buy a certain album copy through their website in order to get an advanced code for their tour. Sometimes you have to be a member of the fan club. And with that fan club, you get a copy of the vinyl record that you could only get when you're a fan club member. So there's so many different configurations now, and they all count towards that Billboard chart. Even though that Billboard might have lost its luster in the last couple of years, certainly. But this is what it means to be a fan. You want access. You want to have everything. You want to collect everything. The Beatles were no different. You know, the Beatles might have only made 2.5 cents off of each single when they were first striking a big in 1964, 65. But the amount of money that they made on Beatles wigs and hats and shirts and dolls and all the rest of the merchandise.
Cans of Beatle breath.
Pardon me?
You could buy cans of Beatle breath. Their breath in a can is what you were promised.
I know. You know what? That demand for your and my breath was, I think, stunted by the fact that they could also buy Paul McCartney's breath. But you know, this all just come down to the whole, division of where money is coming from. It's no wonder that Rihanna is a billionaire, Taylor Swift is a billionaire, Drake is probably a billionaire, The Weeknd is a billionaire. You would never have these people making this kind of money, even when adjusted for inflation, simply because there's just more demand for people to spend money on their favorite artists. Music has never been listened to as much by so many at the same time ever in history. That's what music streaming has done, and that led people down the path to buy concert tickets, buy the book, buy the autobiography, buy the shirt, buy the hat, buy the vinyl record, buy the cassette, buy the CD version of it. It's just a multitude of ways now that artists can make money.
Well, I'm not quite the super music geek that you are, but I'm a pretty big music fan. And when I was younger, even more so. And so back then, the artist didn't get the money, but you and I might have gone into independent record stores and looked around for a while and then quietly asked, do you have any live cassettes? And the guy would, look to make sure you weren't a cop and pull out a box of, bootleg live recordings of concerts. And you had to know who to ask and how to get them. Now the artist sells them themselves and they make the money.
Yeah.
And so good on them.
Paul McCartney had a great line. It was like, he said, every time that I tell a journalist that I don't mind Paul McCartney bootlegs, my lawyer calls me up and says, yes, you do.
Well, the Grateful Dead, they didn't make a lot of money, but they made a living promoting bootlegs. But there's a, I'm sure it's not the only one, but there's a famous concert venue I know of in Glasgow called the Barrowlands. And an artist will play there on Friday night and Saturday morning. You can buy the concert downstairs in the market outside. So it's
Artists tried to do that. There were a number of them pre-COVID. Pearl Jam was one of them, certainly, where within anywhere between a couple of hours and a couple of months, that show would be available for sale on their website or in record store. Pearl Jam once had something like 110 albums, live albums available on their tour in the late 1990s, early 2000s. But it kind of petered out a little bit or a lot because fans realized that they didn't really want the whole concert. What they wanted was 30 seconds of their favorite song on their phone for free.
And you're someone who, this is the space you work in. And I meant to say this earlier, but if you don't follow Eric Alpert on social media, you should, because most of the time you're just putting fun out there into the world, Eric. But you also do put out tips for artists. And one of them is about using social media to grab people and create that connection, create that relationship.
Yeah, it's something that I preached even before I started working in this industry full time back in the late 1990s, was that when I was a kid and I got Billboard magazine as a subscription for my bar mitzvah, that's what I wanted. And I read the stories of the managers and the record labels and the booking agents and the artists. And it seemed that my fascination, even back then, wasn't necessarily always about the music that I was listening to within the grooves of that album. It was the stories that connected me to the artist, what was happening behind the scenes, who I loved, what they were going through, who produced this, who engineered this. It was like my Star Wars. It was my science fiction, trying to figure out how to get into that world, that I loved the stories. And it still kept with me to this day. that nobody really cares about this artist's song. Nobody cares about you as an independent artist, but the connection that they can make to their fan base. Anybody can like your social media post, but to get them to follow you, you have to believe in what the artist is doing, and you have to believe who they are as people, who, well, what they do in their spare time. And unfortunately, that's just the way that it is, especially when you and I and a lot of our listeners grew up not having a clue what Duran Duran did, except when we read about them in Smash Hits or NME or Melody Maker. Mm-hmm. But the dream of thinking about what Led Zeppelin did during their off time, who they were hanging out with, you know, what it was like being a Duran Duran in a musician, was left up to our imagination. Now that's not the case, so you got to kind of spread and reveal as much as you possibly can for people to buy into what you're selling, just like any other market.
You going to continue to go to concerts this summer? I know that you love staying home.
I do.
What are your concert plans?
This is a really busy summer for me. I'm seeing, wait for it, I'm seeing Donny Osmond this Saturday at Niagara. I did an interview with him for my radio show. He might have been the best guest I've ever had on my radio show. He was amazing. Talked a lot about what it's like when you are really the biggest musician on the planet, going from that to absolutely nothing within a short period of 6 years and what that's like. So I'm seeing him. I'm seeing Peter Gabriel, Pink, The Chicks, Springsteen later on this year. So yeah, I'm out there and I'm paying for it all. So I get it. I absolutely understand trying to fight against the boss. But yeah, this summer it seems to be like I missed it. I missed the 15 seconds of excitement that happens when the lights go down and before the artist gets on stage. That's still the high I'm still chasing after all these years back in 1981.
Got to ask you this, just because we are both of a certain similar vintage. When you go to see the oldies acts, like acts that weren't oldies when we were young, and it hurts to think of them now.
Oldies like Mick Jagger at 35 years old?
No, yeah. Well, now, like I went to go see The Cure recently, and they played none of their hit. Well, one hit. Up until the very end, and then they put five hits and a second encore. And other than that, it was all their new music. And I was like, you know, you're on an oldies tour now, Robert. Like, Robert Smith is about to turn 65 and start drawing his British national pension. People want to hear your hits. Do you think artists owe it to play their hits when they're on tours like that?
Yeah, you know, I do as a music fan, but I got to tell you, I've talked to enough of these artists and worked with enough of them to know that it's really hard for them to get up in the morning knowing that they're going to be doing the exact same show as they did 35 years ago. Mentally, it's a challenge. I don't care how much money you get paid. These people are human and you want to make it exciting yourself. Going out on tour may seem fun. You get to stay in luxurious hotels. You get to travel by bus or by plane, eat food, and then go walk out and have 30,000 people adore you for doing whatever you do. But as you get older, though, and your bank account goes a little bit higher, you have, you're away from your family, you're away from your kids, you like being home, and it's a grind. Robert Smith at 65 can't do the thing that he used to do at 30 or 20. And that's the case for a lot of artists who kind of put their bodies through the ringer in the non-health conscious 70s and 80s. So I get it. I think that if you're spending, you know, $450 on a ticket, you want to hear the songs that made them popular. And I think it's always a balance for every artist before they go on tour to devise a set list of what's going to please everybody.
And some artists get the balance and some don't. I didn't feel like The Cure did. And, you know, as far as physically demanding, I just recently saw over the last year, I've seen both Rod Stewart and Billy Joel. They're both up there. Both of them still fantastic performers, but you can tell they're not where they were 10 years ago.
Oh, dude, I have spent the most money I've ever spent on a concert ticket, seeing Genesis on their final tour. I've seen them about 20, 25 times. Their final tour had Phil Collins sitting on a chair, not moving around and not playing drums. I spent $3,500 for a pair of tickets. I saved, and I didn't regret it one second. But there were times when I felt bad for them, not because this was their final tour, but mostly because age catches us all eventually, and some make it to 70 in better shape than others. And it was sad in a way. But then again, whenever I felt down on myself for thinking that at the show, I just looked around and saw people literally crying that they got to see this band before they retired. So to each their own.
I would have loved to have seen Phil Collins and Genesis at that point. So, Eric, I could talk about music with you all day, but we both have to get on with jobs. Listeners have to get on with their lives.
Somebody's got to pay for these concert tickets.
Exactly. We'll talk again soon. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian. It was great to talk to you.
All right. The Full Comment is a post-media podcast. My name's Brian Lilly, your host. This episode was produced by Andre Prue, with theme music by Bryce Hall. Kevin Libben is the executive producer. Again, remember, please subscribe to Full Comment on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, Amazon Music. Listen through your Alexa-enabled devices, everything you can do. And leave us a rating, a review. Tell your friends about us. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Brian Lilly.